Take your Bibles this morning, go to Luke 15, if you would, Luke 15. Today is a little bit of a first for me. First time I've ever preached in BCM Chapel, and I don't know who everyone is. And that's a weird feeling, actually. And I see some of you right. I said, my kids, is that a freshman? I said, I think they're a freshman. Yeah, I think so. I don't recognize them. I haven't been able to meet all of you yet. I've gotten to meet some of you, but not everyone. And I apologize. I haven't gotten around to everyone, but certainly would love to meet you if we've never met before, and at least try to learn everybody's names. I'm trying to do that. So anyway, that's a little bit different for me. So I used to be the one who took your pictures when you come in, at the beginning, and so I knew everybody's name and their face together. It was just part of my job, and so I don't have that privilege anymore, and so it's a little more work now to get to know everybody. So Luke 15, I want to preach from a familiar passage of Scripture here, a familiar parable, and here actually in Luke 15, we actually find Jesus gives three parables connected together, and they're certainly connected. They're certainly a set. He gives them together. It's been oftentimes called the parables of the lost things. Starts off with the parable of the lost sheep, then the parable of the lost coin, and then sometimes it's called the parable of the lost son. And there's a lot of similarities between the parables, but there's also some differences, and there's particularly a lot of similarity between the first two, the parable of the lost sheep, the parable of the lost coin. And definitely so much there. But we get to the third parable, the parable again of the lost son, or sometimes we call it the parable of the prodigal son. That's probably what we call it most often, right? And that's where I want to focus today, is on that third of these three parables that Jesus is giving here. And I don't know, my family would probably say I'm in a little bit of a pattern that I keep on preaching on parables and starting off saying, now, we usually call this the parable of the prodigal son, but I don't really like that name for the parable. I think we should call it something different. And I'm going to do the same thing on this one, okay? And so the word prodigal is certainly not a bad word to use when we're describing this parable. A prodigal is someone who wastes money with extravagant living. That's what the term means, and we certainly see that happening here in this parable, no question about it. And in fact, because of this parable, it's kind of become synonymous, the word prodigal, even in our culture among people who don't believe the Bible, they'll use this word prodigal for someone who wanders away from home and family because of this parable. And it's a reality. It's so well known. And that is a feature of this parable, a son who wanders off, wastes his money. But I tell you, that is not the whole story. It's only half of the story. And in fact, I think if we make the prodigal son the central focus of the story, we actually miss the point. Because this story is not so much about the son who wanders away. There's another brother in the story, too. Did you know that? There's two, all right? And an older brother and a younger brother. And it's not so much about that second brother. In fact, there's also a father in the story. And if I had to give this parable a name, I would call it the parable of the father. The heart of the father. That's the title of the message is the heart of the father. And I want to meditate on that and maybe perhaps look at this with fresh eyes. And sometimes we read a passage of scripture, we're so familiar with it, we can lose a little bit of its potency because we're just, yeah, I've read this so many times. Let's try the best that we can to read this like we've never read it before. I know that's impossible to do, but let's try the best we can this morning, all right? Now, before we do that, I want us to notice the context that Jesus is giving this parable, and because it is important for understanding and interpreting the parable here. Look with me up at verse 1 of chapter 15. It says, "Then drew near unto him all the publicans and sinners for to hear him." Speaking of Jesus. "And the Pharisees and scribes murmured, saying, This man receiveth sinners and eateth with them." And then it says, "And he spake this parable unto them, saying," and he launches into this trio of parables. So notice who it is that Jesus is speaking these parables to. It's spoken to the publicans and sinners, tax collectors, okay, and sinners, as well as Pharisees and scribes. And so you have these who are considered the outcasts, the people nobody wants to have anything to do with because they're the sinful, unrighteous people. Then you have the group over here that is the righteous people, right? That are the ones who know the scriptures and they're living uprightly. Both of them are here in the crowd and they're one side's looking on the other and murmuring. In fact, Jesus is willing to interact with these sinful people. He should be distancing himself. And so as Jesus gives these parables, both of those groups of people are part of the target audience. They're both there listening, and Jesus knows that, and he cares about all of them, not just one side of the equation. And so he gives these parables, and we want to understand that as we apply this text. Now let's go down to verse number 11. This is where we launch into the parable here, the third of the parables. And I'll make a few comments as we go along. Okay, this is verse number 11. It says, "And he said, a certain man had two sons." All right, I mentioned that a moment ago. That's important. Two sons. This is about two boys and their father. It says, "And the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the portion of goods that falleth to me.'" It says, "And he," the father, "divided unto them his living." Now, this was an unusual situation, not usually how things happened. Okay, the two sons, a father, they would inherit all of their father's possessions, all of his wealth. And what would usually happen is when the father died, okay, the father died, then they would separate out, and the older son would get a double portion, so he would get 2/3, and the younger son would get 1/3. And so that was usually, and it would just kind of be split that way. However, there was a provision, though, that would allow for a father, if he wanted to, prior to his death, have a little bit more say on, okay, this is going to go to this son, and this is going to go to this son directly, then he could, prior to his death, lot out the inheritance that way. Now, the way it would work here, the way that it works, is the older son gets the double portion. He gets the family farm, okay? And as long as the father was alive, he still is in control of the farm, overseeing it, though it's now owned by his son. But he still, as the father is still, the younger son gets the cash on hand. He gets the assets in that standpoint. And so that's what he gets. That was his portion. He says, "So give that to me." And it says here that he divided unto them his living. So the father goes along with this, even though it was kind of a little bit insulting, saying, "Dad, we want your stuff." Okay, even though it wasn't really supposed to happen this way, where it was initiated by the son, but the father went with it. He did it. He says he divided them his living. Now, when it says his living, it's literally the idea, the fruit of the labors of his life. Okay, so everything that the father has poured his life into is now being given to his son. So at the end of verse number 12, both sons have their inheritance. Okay, we always focus on the one who goes off and spends it, but both of them have their inheritance. Okay, now the father is still overseeing the farm until he passes away, but it's owned now by the older brother. So now we go to verse number 13. It says, "Not many days after, the younger son gathered all together." So he got all of his stuff, now all that his father has given him, gathered all together, and took his journey, notice these words, into a far country. A far country. And that the idea of that is, looking, he's going as far as he can. Into a distant country, a country that is far being far, okay? It's the idea, it's far off. It says, and there he wasted his substance with riotous living. Extravagant living, just throwing it away. Man, I'm just going to spend here. No thought for the future. That's the idea of the word that's used here. He's not thinking about what's coming later. He's not thinking about the fact, I've got to have stuff a couple years from now. No, it's just like, hey, this is the moment. This is the here and now. I'm just going to live it up now. This moment that we're in. Verse number 14, "And when he had spent all," okay, so now it's all gone. Nothing left. He now doesn't have any resources to continue to live, but it gets worse. It says, "There arose a mighty famine in that land." So here he is. He's far off, far away from dad, far away from home. He spent everything, and so now he doesn't have any more resources to provide for himself. And then it says a famine comes along. Goes from bad to worse. Gets really bad. It says, "And he began to be in want." Oh, now he starts to feel it. Goes from the extravagant life to now, not just, boy, things are tough, to now he literally doesn't have what he needs. He's feeling the pangs of hunger. He's feeling the weakness. And so, verse 15, "He went and he joined himself to a citizen of that country." He says, "Well, I'm going to go. I'm going to find a place where I can get some provision to do something to try to meet my needs." And so that citizen, that man of that country, says he sent him into his fields to feed swine. Now let's talk about this for a moment. Now this is being given in a Jewish context, so we assume that the boy, this younger brother, is a Jewish young man, and so now he's in a far country, away from his people, and now he's had to join himself. He's working for a Gentile, and now he's having to care for the pigs of the Gentile. That's about as low as it can get. Okay, unclean animals, they weren't supposed to have anything to do with them. If you're interacting, I mean, this is bad. He's there taking care of these pigs. He's gone to rock bottom, the low as it can get. And notice this, it says, and he would fain have filled his belly with the husks that the swine did eat. He says, I wish I could eat this food that I'm giving to the pigs. Now, it says here husks, and I thought for a long time that was talking about, you know, it's just kind of what we think of as pig food, you know, the slop of leftover from here and, you know, the corn husks and all this. But the word actually there is a word that's the idea of the fruit of for carob pods. It's the fruit of the carob tree. And it was something that actually it was a tree that grows over in that part of the world, and these pods grow on. They can be eaten by humans. They're not really that palatable, but they're grown and they're fed as food to pigs. And when I discovered that, I got really excited for a minute because I finally understood something from my life. Growing up as a kid, there was a time my mom was always trying to help us be a little more healthy, and there was a time when she tried substituting chocolate chips with carob chips, and it didn't work. It lasted a very short time because they were terrible. And I read this, and I realized, oh man, carob. Now I understand why. Because it's pig food. Was never intended for human consumption. So now you have good argument if that ever happens to you. Carob chips. Absolutely. All right, he says, I wish I could eat this pig food. But notice the last words of that verse. It says, verse 16, it says, and no man gave unto him. So here he is. He's trying to work, but they're taking better care of the pigs than they are of him. The pigs get food. He doesn't. That's how low this has gotten. That's how humiliated he has come. And finally, in that moment, it takes getting to that point, to that rock bottom moment, when it says that when he came to himself. And isn't it, don't we see that reality? That sometimes people, they've got to get to absolute rock bottom. They get to a point in life, you think, oh man, this will wake them up. Nope. Well, this will wake them up to reality. This will cause them to hunger after God, to seek him. Nope. They have to get brought to the lowest of the low of the low of the low before finally they'll wake up to reality. Can I just ask you, young person, what's it going to take for you to wake up? I don't know where you're at today, but what does it take to bring you to a breaking point, to come to yourself? Verse 17, when he came to himself, he said, how many hired servants of my father's have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger. Now, these hired servants are not the people that actually work full-time for his dad. Okay, these are the people that they're day laborers. They're hired hands. So they come in to work on the farm during the day, then they leave and go. But he's saying, listen, those guys, they aren't even full-time servants. They just come in and they work as contractors, but they get enough from my dad to provide for the need. They have enough food to eat and extra. And here I'm wasting away. I'm dying out of hunger. And notice what he says in verse 18. He says, I will arise and go. Notice the next words, to my father. I think those are important words. He doesn't say, I will arise and go home. I will arise and go back to the farm. No, he says, I will arise and go to my father. And will say unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants. By the way, that is a good confession. I have sinned against heaven, against God first. Every time we sin, it's against God. And against thee. He says, I'm no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants. He says, listen, Dad, I don't want to live at home anymore. I don't want to come back. I'm not asking to come back and live at home. I don't deserve that. I'm simply asking, would you let me come and work on the farm during the day? Would you let me be like one of those hired hands? It says, and he arose and came to his father. But when he was yet a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. Notice the love of the father. And the son said unto him, just as he had rehearsed, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. But the father interrupts. But the father said to his servants, bring forth the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring hither the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and be merry, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to be merry. The father doesn't even let him finish his rehearsed confession. Doesn't let him get to, as soon as the father sees this shred of humility, he says, no, let's pour out the blessing. We'll talk about that more in a few moments. Now, verse 25, we've seen the story of the younger son. But now notice that there's another brother. Remember, the certain man had two sons? Now his elder son was in the field. He's still on the farm. And as he came and drew nigh to the house, he heard music and dancing, and he called one of the servants, a little servant boy there, and asked, well, what these things meant? And he said unto him, oh, thy brother is come, and thy father hath killed the fatted calf, because he hath received him safe and sound. Good news. Hey, this is awesome. This is exciting. And he was angry. You see those words? And he was angry and would not go in. Therefore, came his father out and entreated him. And as the father pleads with him and entreats with him, here's what the son answers. He answering said to his father, lo, these many years do I serve thee, neither transgressed I at any time thy commandment. And yet thou never gavest me a kid. So listen, you gave him the fatted calf. You never even gave me a little goat, that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this thy son was come, which hath devoured thy living, the fruit of your life, he's thrown it away with harlots. Thou hast killed for him the fatted calf. And he said unto him, son. And that word is, the emotion of that word is, my dear son, the one that I love. Son, thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine. That's reality at this moment. The younger son's gotten everything. Everything that the father has belongs to the older son now. He says, it was meet, it was necessary, it was right, it was important that we should make merry and be glad, for this thy brother was dead and is alive again and was lost and is found. I want to look at this parable for a few minutes. We've taken a little bit of time to go through it here, but I want to just now look at a couple of points from this parable to help us understand this truth, that you miss fellowship with the Father when you don't understand the heart of the Father. I want to begin by just thinking some about these two distant brothers. The distant brothers. First of all, we see the younger brother, who is, I think we could say, distanced by self-indulgence. Self-indulgence is the excessive or unrestrained gratification of one's own appetites, desires, or whims. Can I put it this way? Self-indulgence is doing whatever you want to do, whenever you want to do it, no matter what it means for anyone else. Saying, listen, what do I feel like doing right now? That's what I'm going to do. It's pursuing pleasure at any cost. It's living without breaks in your life. It's living for today with no thought of tomorrow and certainly not of eternity. Self-indulgent living. And by the way, self-indulgence never starts with the big thing. We see a big moment in this guy's life right here. But his self-indulgence didn't start here. It starts in the small areas. And we'll never get to that big area of self-indulgence if we don't start with the small areas of self-indulgence. Maybe today you haven't walked away from everything like this young man did, but you're indulging in other smaller areas in your thoughts, your attitudes, your slumber in bed, your time at the mealtimes, your entertainment. Self-indulgence, it's like a snowball though, right? It grows quickly and exponentially. And so we get to the life of this younger brother, and we see just absolute tragedy unfold, right? As he goes away to this far country, he distances himself from his father, and he's literally living for whatever I want to do. But friend, the greatest tragedy in this phase of the story is not that this younger brother has thrown away everything that he had, though that is absolutely tragic. Not that he's thrown away the fruit of his father's labor, though that's tragic. Self-indulgence, young person, will always cost you more than you ever thought it would. Indulging in those thoughts, in those attitudes, in those images, in those responses, in that communication, those things, it'll always cost you more than you think. It will always lead you to a place you didn't expect to go. It's tragic. Yes, he's thrown everything away. It's cost him much. But that's not the greatest tragedy of the story. The tragedy is not that he finds himself in a despicable situation here, in a despicable position, doing shameful work and earning very little in return. How demoralizing can that be? It's terrible. It's hard to swallow. But that's where unbridled self-indulgence often brings us, friends. To the end of our rope, to rock bottom, utterly destitute. Yes, it's a tragedy. But can I tell you, that is nothing compared to the real tragedy of the story. You see, self-indulgence, it results in shame. Boy, we see that here. I'm no more worthy to be called your son. Feeling worthless. Man, yeah. I don't really have any worth here to anyone. I mean, I'm feeding pigs. They're not even feeding me. It leads us to that place of distrust. He's going and he's thinking, this is how my father is towards his hired servants. I hope he'll be that way to me. No confidence in what his father's going to do. Shame, feeling worthless, distrust. Some of you know exactly what that feels like because you've lived there. Perhaps even today you're there. You've done what you feel like, feeding your own desires, and you're reaping the consequences. You've sown to the wind, and as they say, you've reaped the whirlwind. And as a result, your heart is filled with shame, with doubt, with fear, because that's where self-indulgence eventually leads you. It's tragic. But even that is not the real tragedy of this story. I can tell you what I believe the greatest tragedy of the account of this younger brother is that the entire time that all this is happening, he is living distant from the Father who loves him, from a father who is longing for a relationship with him, from a father who has everything that he needs, from a father who is ready to receive him with open arms. And the younger brother is missing out on all of it. Oh yes, he's the father's son, but there's no relationship taking place. There's no friendship going on. They're living distant when the Father is longing to be close. That's the tragedy. And that is the tragedy, friends, of self-indulgence, of doing what our flesh wants to do. It leads us away from the Father. It destroys our relationship with the Father. It distorts our view of His heart towards us. It robs us of the opportunity to experience all that our Father wants to be in our lives. And so we live distant when the Father wants to be close. And so we have to ask the question, well, why is it? Why is it that we run to self-indulgent things when we have a Father who longs to be close to us? And I think there is only one answer we can have to that question, and that is this, that the reason that we choose self-indulgence, choosing to live distant from the Father, is because we don't understand our Father's heart towards us. We think that being away from Him is going to be better than being with Him. Can you believe it? But that's where the Son was. And I'm afraid that's where you and I often live. This younger brother thought that turning to other things besides his Father would satisfy him. He thought that taking things, what his Father could give him, and using that to gratify his fleshly desires for popularity, for relationship, for position, would fulfill that longing for love and adventure and acceptance in his life. But the whole time, what he really needed was right there in the heart of his Father. Oh, listen, friends, we are so often just like that younger son. We don't understand the heart of our Father. We somehow think that other things can give us what only our Father can give us. And so we go to entertainment. We go to sports. We go to hobbies. We go to the refrigerator. We go to human relationships. We find ourselves running from this thing to that thing, to this thing over here, to this podcast, to this news feed, to this app, to this pursuit, to this. And we're searching. We're longing for something. And we find something that maybe makes us feel good temporarily, but it comes up short in the long run. Because those things can never provide what we really need. What we really need can only be found in the heart of our Father. Oh, but other things, boy, this is going to be better than Him. Because we don't actually understand His heart toward us. Now, there's a second brother. Okay, so the first brother, he's distanced from the Father by self-indulgence. But we have another, the older brother. He too is distanced by self-righteousness. Self-righteousness. You see, while he's near the Father geographically, right? He's working in the fields. He's near the house. He's on the farm. He's close geographically. He too is distant from the Father. He too doesn't know his Father because he doesn't understand his Father's heart. And so when this moment comes and his Father is pouring out blessing on this his younger brother, and the son says, "What on earth are you thinking, Dad?" Because he doesn't know his dad's heart. Doesn't get it. Even though he's so close geographically. Even though he's doing things for the Father out of obligation. Out of duty. He's trying to be faithful to his responsibility. He still doesn't have a relationship with the Father. Listen, self-righteousness is consumed with service for God. Working in the fields, putting in a lot of great effort, seeking to build the kingdom and make a difference for God, living for the cause, doing the stuff that you should do. And not taking time to actually know the Father. And so we live like the older brother. We find him here, he's saying, "Listen, look at everything I've done, Dad. I've checked every box. I've crossed every T. I have not gone the way of the world. I work hard to do the right things. I've kept the right standards. I live by the right principles. Surely I deserve something more for that, more than this rebel over here. This is not justice. And so we find him sitting outside. Sitting outside, refusing to go in, missing out of all the blessings of fellowship with the Father. Choosing instead to magnify the faults of others, refusing to forgive, and lauding his own worthiness. You see, self-righteousness often results in a judgmental spirit towards other people. Critical. Magnifying their faults. There may be faults there, but boy, we know how to blow them up, don't we? Self-righteousness often results in a lack of forgiveness. Holding on to that grudge, refusing to let it go. A sense of entitlement. Boy, I deserve something for what I've done. Can I ask you, what's your attitude towards others today? Are you perhaps like this older brother? Has self-righteousness crept into your life? See, though he's close in location to his Father, though he's laboring for him, his response is so clearly reveals that he did not understand the heart of the Father. He too was not living in that vibrant relationship, sharing heart to heart with his Father. And it's very easy, young people, to be in a place like this, immersed in the activity and service for God. Studying to serve God. Surrounded by people who want to serve God. So close geographically. And yet, live distant from God. Failing to actually develop a relationship with Him and enter into His heart. Could that be you, my friend? See, I want to warn you that there's a real danger for those of us who are conservative, for those of us who have high standards, for those who, you know, hold to the old paths, for who were faithful to the truth. There's a danger. In our faithfulness, we can miss the heart of our Father. And we can fall into the sin of the older brother, self-righteousness, a critical spirit towards others, a meritorious thinking. We do the right things, and yet we can miss the relationship with God. See, when it comes down to it, actually, both of these brothers, younger and older, actually had the same problem. Oh, it looked differently in their life. But they both missed relationship with their Father. They both didn't understand their Father's love. They both cared more about what the Father could give them than about the Father Himself. They both wanted the rights of their sonship without the relationship of sonship. I wonder how often we have that same problem. We don't understand our Father's heart. We don't comprehend our Heavenly Father's love because we live distant from Him. Dare I even say we often care more about what our Father can give to us than we actually care about our Father Himself. The distant brothers. Now I want to hasten on. We need to see the loving Father. The loving Father. We see this love manifested in two different ways. First of all, I want you to see the love of the Father is an embracing love. Look again at verse 20. It says, he arose and came to his father, but when he was yet a great way off, his father saw him Now, the only way this really makes sense is if the Father's looking for him. Yeah, the idea of, it's like he's saying he's far off, being very far off. So it's like I just barely can't make out, and his Father sees him. He's looking for his son, even a long way off. And when he sees him, he drops what he's doing, and the Father takes off running. Man, I just picture it, beard flying back, robe flying back, dust clouds. He's taken off. And it says here that he sees him and he has compassion. His heart is overwhelmed with love for that son. And so he takes off running. And what's the very first thing the father does when he gets to that son? He gets up to him, he reaches him, and he says, "It's about time you came around." Right? He says, gets it, "All right, well, son, do you have anything to say?" Is that what he does? No. No, look what it says. It says, he saw him, had compassion, and ran, and fell on his neck and kissed him. The very first thing that the father does is wrap his arms around him and pulls him in close in the warmest display of affection that a father could show towards his son. He doesn't wait for an explanation. He's not waiting for an apology before he shows that love, because that's not who he is. That's not his heart towards us as his children. What the father is showing his heart, he's saying, "Listen, I don't care what you've done. It doesn't matter how broken you are. It doesn't matter how distant you've been. It doesn't matter how deeply you have wronged me. I still love you, and I want you to be close. You're mine." Friend, that's the heart of God, our Father, towards you. If we could just wrap our mind around it here today, young people, the heart of our Father towards us is this, that the greater our sin and failure and brokenness, the more his heart is drawn towards us. We sometimes get this idea in our mind that the more that I sin, the more God withdraws himself from me because he's holy and he's disgusted by our sin. And don't get me wrong, he is holy. And sin is repugnant, but that's not his response toward us as his children. You see, his heart as a father towards us is so tender and so compassionate that when he sees us under the heavy weight of sin and shame, when he sees us broken and pressed down by the just consequences of our wicked choices, his heart is drawn towards us. His heart yearns for us. His heart of love for us breaks, and his compassion compels him to move towards us in that moment, not away from us, to meet our need, not to withdraw. Oh, if we could just truly understand and trust in the heart of our Father, in his unending, unfailing love for us, it would eradicate our struggle with self-indulgence. You see, this first son, he had come to a point where he realized, listen, the father's loving enough that being a hired servant would be better than being away from him. But he didn't get the love of his father still. He wasn't even close. But he understood enough of the love of the father that he said, "Listen, I'm gonna take a humble step towards him." And when that son comes and the father embraces him, and the father there, the son begins to give his apology, the father doesn't wait for him to finish what he's saying. The father is so longing to pour out his blessings on this wayward son that the moment he sees a spark of humility, he interrupts the speech and says, "No, let the floodgates open. Pour out the blessing." All he's looking for is a little spark of humility, young person. That's all he wants to see. And he's ready to pour out the blessing. Oh, listen, the sin matters. It's not something that's irrelevant, but he wants to deal with that. He wants to meet that need, to heal that brokenness. Our Father's not looking for perfection. He's not looking for penance. He's not looking for promises of doing better. He's not looking for a track record of success. All he's looking for is humility. Humble, true honesty I love the words of Psalm 86. For thou, Lord, art good and ready to forgive, and plenteous in mercy unto all that them that call upon thee. A little later in the psalm, but thou, O Lord, art a God full of compassion and gracious, long-suffering and plenteous in mercy and truth. Do you understand? This is the heart of our God, an embracing love. But we see as well, in his response to the older brother, that the love of our God is not just an embracing love. The heart of our Father is also a pursuing love. You see, the father wasn't content to just enjoy the celebration and the festivities inside with the son that's come home, while the other son was sitting outside, fuming, refusing to come in. No, he's not willing that this son too should remain distant. So he leaves the party. He leaves the celebration to pursue this son that is trapped in self-righteousness. That is the heart of our God, the God who left the glories of heaven, who left the endless praise, who took on sorrow and suffering and sin in order to pursue you and me in our lost condition. And having saved us, he is still not content for us to be distant. He is still pursuing us, drawing us near, even in our arrogance and our pride, because he wants you and me to be close. Oh, listen, friend, do you hear his gentle call? Son, my child, my dear child, do you hear his gentle call today inviting you to draw close? Do you feel his touch on your shoulder pleading with you to lose yourself in his love? And yes, as the father pursued this near but distant son, he had to tenderly, gently, patiently correct his wrong thinking, right? The son lays out his... This is how I think that the son says, oh, son, you've missed it. This is right for me to do this. He had to expose the error of his son's lack of forgiveness, of his critical spirit. But as he does, he's revealing his heart to his son. In his pursuing love, he's seeking to open the eyes of this distant one to his embracing love so that the son can enter into the heart of the father. He's seeking to draw this son who is so close geographically but so distant in heart to draw him near to his heart. Well, listen, there's times when our Father, in his steadfast, unchanging love, in his pursuit of us, in our pride, where he has to correct us, and it's never enjoyable, is it? But it's always because he's seeking to open our eyes to his heart towards us. Think of the words of Proverbs 3 that are quoted in the book of Hebrews. My son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, neither be weary of his correction. Notice this, for whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth, even as the Father, the Son, in whom he, what's the word? Delighteth. Listen, the reason that God corrects you isn't because he is angry and upset with you. It's because he delights in you. His heart is so set towards you and your good that he cannot just stand idly by and let you stay distant. He can't let you just continue on in your pride outside the joys of his blessing and love. No, he pursues after you to the ends of the earth. He pleads gently, earnestly, that you might know him, that you might know his heart. Oh, can you see the heart of the Father? An embracing love, a pursuing love. And I have done a poor job in describing his love today. We conclude very quickly with this. Number three, the open question. We've seen the distant brothers. We've seen the heart of the Father, the loving Father. But now notice the open question. Did you notice that in this account of these two brothers, we're never told how they respond to the Father's love? Oh, we can speculate. We imagine in our minds, certainly, how they responded. But in reality, Jesus doesn't actually tell us how they responded. He leaves it open-ended. Because how they responded isn't actually the point. The point is this: how are you going to respond to the love of the Father? You see, the question isn't so much, which one of these brothers are you? Now, no doubt, remember the group that was listening to this? Pharisees, publicans, and sinners? No doubt by the end of the account, they knew which one they were. Sinners,
boy, we're the younger brother, self-indulgent.
Pharisees,
he's talking about us. He's saying we are self-righteous.
No question they knew which one they were. And there certainly is value and merit to us asking that question, which one am I? Which one do I have a tendency to go towards? Am I self-indulgent or am I self-righteous? There's value in asking that question, which brother am I? But there's a far deeper question that Jesus is leading us to answer this morning. And that is this question, how will you respond to the love of the Father today? Will you embrace His heart towards you? Listen, I don't know what your need is. I don't know what it is that you're facing. And if I did, I could never meet that need. But I do know this. You have a Heavenly Father who sees, who knows, who understands, and who cares, and He is longing to meet that need. And today, if you could just grab hold of His love, if you could just enter into to that reality of His heart towards you, you would find that He's ready to meet you where you are and meet that need. Today we've seen just a glimpse of that love. So the question is, will you embrace the heart of the Father? How will you respond to that love? Oh, listen, we miss out on fellowship with the Father when we don't understand His heart. And He's seeking to open your eyes to understand that heart today. But what are you going to do with that love? What are you going to do with the love of the Father?